So I wanted to begin today's talk about loving kindness, because I feel that a retreat about happiness is not complete if we don't include loving kindness. It's one of the most powerful, beautiful ways to develop a kind of happiness that is very wholesome, very ethical. And as Bernard was saying yesterday, as human beings we have a natural inclination towards happiness, of course. Who wouldn't want to be happy? And yet, often we seek for that happiness in places that maybe aren't as satisfying as we may wish. So this is a way to redirect that natural search for happiness in a very wholesome way. And loving kindness can be an attitude of mind, a disposition, or a way of regarding the world, and also a cultivation, something we can actually train in, something we can practice and grow in our hearts. It also comes about through repeated action, repeated planting of those beautiful seeds of love. And loving kindness is known in Buddhism as basically any act of benevolence that has a person's true well-being at heart. So it's a benevolence that includes all beings, and that is the difference between loving kindness and other kinds of love. In the suttas it says, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should we cherish all living beings. So the idea of a mother's love is something protective, something nurturing, something that allows that child to thrive, is a very good indication of the kind of intention of loving kindness, the quality of it. But the difference here is that in Buddhism it's known as appamāna, which means boundless. So it's not only towards one's own family, one's own child, or even one's own self, but towards all loving beings. We have to develop this bit by bit by bit. And when we can develop a heart that is full of loving kindness, that is inherently a very beautiful place to abide. It's a very joyful and light state of mind. And it's ethical because it's concerned with the benefit not only of oneself but of others and of the whole of society too. As we said yesterday, suffering is universal, and the answer to that needs to be universal too. It needs to be something that applies to all of us. And loving kindness is a way, it's also called Sima Sambheda, which means breaking boundaries. And it is a way to overcome the discriminatory tendencies of mind that divide us from one another or exclude some people, other some people, marginalize others. We start to be able to have the same intentions of loving kindness towards all beings, because we know that all beings recoil from pain and desire their own happiness. So loving kindness is also an ethical motivation for kind acts of body, speech, and mind. And in the suttas, it's known as a force for harmony, especially harmony in family, harmony in community, and harmony in the greater world. And we're advised to practice thoughts, words, and deeds of loving kindness in public and in private. And loving kindness practice is a way of doing that in private. We're conditioning our mind by the ways we use thought. And I find this fascinating, because when we start to use thought in a directed way, thoughts such as, may I be happy, may I be well, may I be safe, may I be at peace, or whatever thoughts bring up feelings of goodwill and benevolence towards yourself or towards others, and we use these thoughts again and again, a little bit like planting those seeds that Bernard was so beautifully talking about today. It's almost as though most of the energy, or effort if you like, but a very gentle and persistent effort, goes into planting those seeds. And then we leave the results to nature. We plant them in a fertile soil, and we use our mindfulness and kindness just to listen in to the resonance of those phrases and allow the emotion to grow. It might start to manifest as a physical feeling of maybe more spaciousness or softness, maybe a subtle feeling of warmth or lightness, maybe a brightness, or even quite a strong, pleasant feeling, often centered around the heart. But it's interesting to see the way that these thoughts can condition our emotions. It's almost another way around from the practice of something like Vipassana, where we first of all get in contact with our sensations in the body, and from there we can see how thoughts arise. For example, if we have particularly disagreeable sensations, or maybe a knot in the stomach or some anxiety, then the thoughts that arise are likely to be thoughts of fear, thoughts of anxiety, maybe a sense of feeling unsafe. With loving kindness, of course, we can start from the feeling if it's naturally there for us, but it can also grow from a thought, from an intention, from the way we incline the mind. And this is really beautiful because the Buddha says in one of the suttas, it's called the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 19, for those who may wish to open the suttas at some point, he says that whatever we frequently reflect and ponder upon becomes the inclination of our mind. So we condition the way our mind inclines by the way we use thought, by the way we use intention. And over time, this becomes our inclination. It means we start leaning towards that perspective of loving kindness that we can have for the world, rather than a perspective of maybe ill will or frustration, anger, fighting and disagreeing with the world. We can actually move more into thoughts of loving kindness. And it's also a very powerful sutta because the Buddha points out that whenever you have a thought of loving kindness, it's impossible at that time for a thought of ill will to arise. So it actually supplants the possibility for negative thoughts to arise in the mind. A thought of compassion makes it impossible at the same time to have a thought of cruelty. And a thought of renunciation. I like the word renunciation, but to many people that might sound a little bit dry. So think of renunciation as a thought of giving, giving something away, giving something up, freeing yourself from burdens. Thoughts of renunciation in this way are the opposite of sensual desire. It's not possible for these two to arise at the same time. So this is really powerful because even if you're not feeling particularly full of love or particularly inclined towards love and kindness at any given time, sometimes we're in a grumpy mood, right? But even so, if we can at least have a thought, may I be happy, or may I be even free from this sadness or pain, then at that time you're not generating more unwholesomeness on top of something that's already arisen that you dislike. So in this way, we start to change the course of our mind and generate these very positive feelings which can arise and that are associated with loving kindness. It's almost as though we're starting to create a loving environment in our mind. And because of that, the mind grows, it grows bigger, it grows more boundless and able to contain so much more of the pain of life without feeling shattered or shaken. There's some resource there. The mind becomes soft, malleable, even bouncy. You can think of resilience as a kind of bounciness. It's not resisting what life throws, but it's able to respond and bounce back. So the sustained practice, the persistent, gentle practice of loving kindness is very powerful and can lead all the way into the jhanas, the deep states of samadhi, which are equivalent to the four brahma viharas. So this is where metta becomes really, really strong. We can do the same with compassion, with sympathetic joy, and also with equanimity. We can create those emotions, those feelings so strong, those inclinations in our mind so strongly that we actually start to abide in them more and more and more. They become a place we can resort to again and again. And that's what's meant by vihara, dwelling. They become a dwelling place for the mind. And Brahma is like the God realm in Buddhist cosmology. The Brahma realm is full of beings who've done a lot of good deeds and who are experiencing a lot of happiness and bliss. So at that time, you know, when we enter these deep states of samadhi, it's as though it does feel like union with God. And my teacher, Ajahn Brahm, who has a certain, I guess he has cultivated a lot of deep samadhi in his practice life and also a lot of metta. And he says it's easy to understand for him how, you know, experiencing those states can feel like union with God. And maybe in the mystic traditions and the Christian traditions, this is how it's interpreted. But I also wanted to talk about how the samadhi and the happiness that can arise from the practice of loving kindness is not an end in of itself. But even the process of practice starts to uncover a lot of insight, a lot of wisdom, if we know where to look. And the result of samadhi, first of all, samadhi is caused by happiness. The Buddha says, sukhino chittam samadhiyati. Samadhi, or deep states of calm, deep states of sustained awareness, which sounds a bit technical. I prefer stillness as a translation for that term. They're caused by happiness. Yeah. Again, not the happiness of excitement, but the happiness born of peace. And furthermore, samadhi states themselves are the cause for seeing things as they truly are. And we touched on this a bit last night with the questions, you know, how when the hindrances are overcome, in a sense, the curtains are removed from the mind, then we have a much clearer vision. We can see things more clearly and without distortion. And because of that also, we have less vested interest in what we're about to see. We have this strength of mind, which is resource, but also a freedom of inquiry. And the Buddha says that the mind becomes malleable, the mind becomes soft, because the hindrances have been removed. So how does loving kindness relate to wisdom, and how does it lead to insights? What kind of insights can we start to uncover through the practice of metta? And one of the most simple insights, but an important insight that can happen with this practice, is that it's an aspect of right view, because it helps us to understand and discern the wholesome from the unwholesome. The Buddha said that that is one aspect of right view, wise perspective, or wise view, if you like, being able to discern the kind of actions of body, speech, and mind that are going to lead to freedom and those which are not. And we can experience that as wholesome, ethical behavior or unethical behavior that feeds those roots of greed, hatred, and delusion in the mind. So we start to be able to discern this really easily, again, becoming easier because those particular thoughts happen to lead to very wholesome states. And that discernment in the practice of loving kindness is important throughout. And it can guard loving kindness from slipping into a kind of bland sentimentality or a kind of cover that we want to put on as a layer over the suffering we feel, right? Sometimes people think of loving kindness as this kind of slapping a nice happy feeling over something that's actually quite difficult. That's not what loving kindness is about. It's about learning to relate with kindly eyes, learning to create an environment, a loving environment in which we can thrive. You know, it's been shown time and again through psychology studies and, I guess, other research that children who are raised in loving environments where they feel safe, where their needs are met, their emotional needs, they tend to thrive physically, emotionally, probably intellectually as well, because they feel loved. And some of us might not have had a perfectly loving environment. In fact, I doubt any of us have always felt loved. But we can develop a loving environment within our own mind that can heal some of that, those emotionally unmet needs, perhaps. And we can tend to ourselves like a loving mother might. And also, the wisdom as part of the loving kindness can stop or can guard loving kindness from its near enemy, which is passion or lust. And again, it's that universality of loving kindness, so we approach it in a very systematic way. Sometimes we can begin with a person who's easy to develop loving kindness towards. And I think that's fine, even if it's not yourself. You know, we start with what we've got. We start with where we find it easy to rouse feelings of loving kindness, even if this is towards a pet, towards a child, towards someone who you have a very simple relationship of goodwill towards. Nothing too complicated from the past, nothing that needs working out, maybe nothing too intense as well in the beginning, because once you start bringing this being into mind, you might start spinning off into stories and start to practice in an attempt to improve either your relationship or that person. And this is not what loving kindness is about. Loving kindness is about loving and caring for another person's well-being no matter what, whether they make us feel good, whether they fulfill our needs, whether we like them or not, whether they are like us or not. It has to start to spread. So we start with something very simple and we continue with a increasingly perhaps more difficult category of being. So for me, I usually start with a loved person, sometimes with myself, but usually I move on to myself once I've got that strong feeling for someone I really respect and who is, in a sense, an example of that love that I seek to embody and imbibe. And then we can move on to somebody we don't really have many feelings about, the so-called neutral person, but it really means a person towards whom our feelings are quite balanced and maybe not very strong, somebody that you maybe barely know. And you haven't really taken the time to consider their own humanity in the sense of perhaps what they might be going through, you know? Sometimes we look at people and they behave in a strange way and we think, goodness me, I would never do that. Why do they behave like that? Huh, this person was rude to me and all I said was hello. And it's interesting because it happened to me once in a monastery that I said bless you to one of the nuns over breakfast and she grouched. She said, you don't have to say that, it's only a sneeze. And I had this impression, you know, from this, that this person was rather grumpy and this behaviour was, yeah, I'd seen it a few times. So I added, you know, all the evidence up about two incidents and decided that this person's grumpy, you know. Maybe they're not very kind. But later on, I actually discovered that they had suffered a huge trauma in their life and lost somebody very, very close to them. And it was extraordinary to see how my perception of that person and my feelings changed completely when I knew what they'd been through. And I try to remember this because it's a good, sobering reminder of the fact that we never know what's going on for someone else. We never know why they behave the way they do. But we can usually guess, we can hazard a guess that somewhere in there they're in pain. You know, somewhere inside we're all in pain, right? There's tender places in all our hearts. And we don't tend to respond in a hostile way when we're happy, when we're full of love. So it's interesting as a practice, particularly for me, to start to see the conditioned nature of our perception. And one way that I've noticed this is when I am practicing a lot of metta, I notice that the way I regard the world is conditioned by my mental state at the time. So to give you an example, it's like maybe you get up on the wrong side of bed and that morning you feel really tired and the first thing your partner or your friend says to you is like, oh, why didn't you get up in time to make the tea or something like this? And you just feel even worse. You feel really grumpy and you start to perceive that person as very demanding and unsympathetic and not considerate of your needs, right? And you forget that perhaps, you know, it's they didn't even mean it in a bad way, but because you were a little bit irritable and tired already, you took it that way, and you created an image of that person. Another day, you wake up and get out of bed after a great sleep, and you reflect on something beautiful in your life, feelings of loving kindness come up. Maybe you've been good students of this retreat, and you start the day with a few phrases of loving kindness. And your partner says, oh, you didn't put the kettle on yet. And you say, great, it's my opportunity to do that for you. I can make you a cup of tea. I'd love to do that. And you have a wonderful breakfast together and you feel so grateful that you've got this partner to have a beautiful cup of tea with, right? And that's because in your mind you had metta, you had love and kindness. And you start to even perceive your past in a very positive way. You know, the worries that you had about your future start to turn into hope. I've noticed with the monastery, you know, if I'm busy and stressed or if something's happened that's triggered me in some way, I look into the future and think, gosh, it's going to be really difficult. I'm going to have no end of problems. People will come who need all my time, and people will have all kinds of psychological issues that don't really belong in a monastery. Ah, how am I going to cope, you know? But then at other times, when I've been practicing a lot of metta and I'm kind of connected to the motivation behind what I do, oh, I can see so much potential, you know, in the future and the opportunity to do something really meaningful with my life. And one interesting thing actually was that a couple of years ago I had a melanoma on my arm, completely out of, well, I had quite a big mole, it was quite a strange looking thing. But one day I looked down and it was definitely not right. And I immediately knew, oh, it's turned into a melanoma. So I went to a specialist, actually, because I had to act pretty quick. And they said, yeah, we're sure it is, but you've got to wait for the weekend to, you know, have a proper check. And so I had the weekend to myself, and I got these feelings of fear welling up from time to time. But interestingly, interspersed with overwhelming feelings of love. And I did see a few people at that time, and my heart was so full of tenderness, and I really had this sense of the value of my life. You know, before then I was a little bit blasé. I thought, yeah, I'm a nun, I reflect on life and death. If I'm dying young, that's fine, you know, I'm ready for that. But then I realised, no, actually, I really value my life, and I want to keep going with what I'm doing, even though it's hard. And that surprised me, it actually really surprised me, because sometimes we forget to see the value in what we do. I read some interesting research actually about people's perception of their life. And one of the things I read is that when people die with a lot of pain, in a lot of pain, or they have a lot of chronic pain leading up to their death, they tend to view their whole life as being more difficult. Even if they didn't have that much pain throughout the rest of their life. Because it's that last perception that conditions the way they view the past. Yeah. People who have less chronic pain when they're dying, maybe die peacefully, even if they had a much more difficult life, tend to view their life as quite pleasant, quite positive. And I was thinking of this and how it applies to me, and I thought, I can imagine that's the case also with retreats. Maybe this is helpful because they've only been 3 days. But if your retreat ends and you're feeling grumpy and you're feeling down and you're having a lot of pain or grief, you might then perceive the whole retreat as difficult. You're more likely to, right? But if you end in the middle of a really nice meditation, you'll be like, this retreat was great, you know? And it's totally biased. It's totally dependent on the state of mind you have now. So we see things through our lenses of perception. And it's also evidenced in the way that these categories we use start to change. You know, sometimes we're practicing with a love person and they become our, you know, our go-to person for generating loving kindness. But after an argument, you don't quite know which category they belong. On the other hand, you can be developing loving kindness for someone you don't even know, for a neutral person. And because you're having those very benevolent, kind, you know, simple thoughts that this, about this person's well-being, their safety, their health, you'll find that when you meet them next time, you actually feel a sense of warmth. And lo and behold, that person may respond to you as if you are their friend. So where is the reality in any of this? And I find this fascinating because what it shows me is that perception is conditioned. There is no inherent reality to any of this, right? We create our reality by the way we view the world, by the condition of our mind at any time. So that being so, why don't we try to cultivate perceptions that lead to wholesome states? Some people can say that, oh, it's not true, it's fake, it's just, you know, the eyes of metta, it's like rose-tinted glasses. But at this stage in the practice, our main job is to overcome the hindrances to deep meditation so we really can get clarity of vision. We really can have that freedom of inquiry, that we can see things clearly without vested interests or bias. So why not use whatever means we can to cultivate those wholesome states? And of course, one of the most unwholesome states that we want to overcome is ill will, aversion. It's at the root of all of the hindrances, right? The other side of craving is aversion. You know, you don't have what you want, you feel annoyed about that. Or you have what you want and you lose it, you feel annoyed, right? You crave because you haven't got something you like. So an aversion feeds into all the other hindrances. We go to sleep to dull out because we don't like what we're watching, you know. We feel bored with it. We're restless because we don't want to stay with this rotten old breath and this pain in the body anymore, right? So, and doubt as well. It's like, it's a very unpleasant state. So when we start to practice metta, it actually has an effect of weakening all those hindrances. And it also has the advantage of rousing happiness relatively quickly in the practice. Yeah, it takes a bit longer to get to the stage in breath meditation, for me at least, and I think this is the experience of many people. Of course, it depends on the person. It depends from time to time with each person too. But generally speaking, metta tends to develop pleasant, warm, open, spacious, loving feelings much more quickly than other kinds of meditation. And I use that in my practice. Someone was telling me in the interviews that they're finding this happens for them as well. I like to begin with some loving kindness and just get my mind to a state of calm and well-being. I don't have to be feeling bliss and full of love for the whole world. You know, this is unrealistic in a short space of time. But at least to balance the mind so that main hindrance is not predominant anymore, that hindrance of ill will, and to have a sense of well-being. And once that well-being is there, it tends to soften the mind, it tends to calm the mind. You know, people who are feeling loved, when you're in a loving environment, you tend to relax, you tend to become calm. There's nothing to defend or protect. So loving kindness helps us to become calm. And because of that, it's easy when the breath arises to stay with that breath. So we make this beautiful container, this beautiful atmosphere into which the breath can be invited in. And for me, I don't even have to invite it these days because I know the breath is a beautiful thing. And I just refine my mind to the extent that it's able to meet that breath in a way that is easy to stay with. You know, if your friend comes into your house, do you grab them by the arm and kind of force them to sit down? Do you think they would stay? They'd be like, get off me, I want to get out of here as soon as I can. And it's the same with our breath. If we go and grab that breath and pull it inside, it's going to try and leave us as soon as it can. You know, but if you have your door open and you create a beautiful atmosphere in your home, you put the chai on, make some nice chai, and you put maybe the oven on with some bread, and there's this beautiful smell and maybe some candles, then the guest gets attracted in. So in the similar way, we put all these beautiful qualities in our mind, and that invites in these subtle states like the breath. And we can be with that breath in a way that doesn't take much force at all. Sometimes it just becomes a resting place for the mind. And we can continue a little bit of loving kindness. We can add maybe just a simple word to the breath, you know. Maybe you've been practicing with a phrase like, may I be happy, may you be happy, or may you be content. You can maybe just breathe in with the word content. Breathe out with the word peace. Or just add a phrase every so often if you see your mind becoming tight, becoming tense. So we can use the metta practice in this way, and it's a beautiful way of practice. I do want to share one more experience of the conditioned nature of the mind that relates to something in the suttas. It's called the salt crystal in the Anguttara Nikaya, and I forget the place. Is it 10.3 or something like that? Do you have any idea? It's in the Anguttara Nikaya. I've tried to find it anyway. And it's very beautiful because it's basically talking about how the mind in the present conditions what arises from time to time. So the simile is that if you have a glass of water. Okay, so imagine your mind is like a glass of water and you've got this big lump of salt and you put that in the glass of water. The glass of water becomes undrinkable, right? But if you put the same size salt crystal into a huge body of water, a beautiful lake, you don't even notice the salt. You can drink it, you can get quenched. It's beautiful water all the same. And this is how the mind is. When the mind is full of impurities, if you like, when it's brittle with the hindrances, it's like a small glass. And if something comes along like a bad memory from the past, it just colours the whole water. It makes it impossible to drink, right? You can't get any replenishment from that glass of water. It's terrible. Your whole mind is salty. But if something from the past comes up, when the mind is big, when the mind is boundless, immeasurable, as these states of loving kindness imply, mahagata, the mind gone to greatness, then you won't even notice the impact of that salt. And this happened to me with a traumatic event in my past. I was actually at Gaia House many years ago, practicing loving kindness in the Hermitage Ring, and something traumatic had happened with me with a very close friend who'd basically physically assaulted me a couple of times. And I'd had this view that friends don't do that. Friends are incredibly pure relationships, and she's my sister, it's impossible for that to happen. That does not happen in the world. Sounds quite naive, I guess. But that was the case. So I was traumatized, and I decided not to send this person loving kindness because I was in more need of my own kindness first. And to bring this person to mind would trigger me in some way. I would feel this in my stomach. I would feel this world isn't the safe space I used to think it was. But one day I was practicing loving kindness, and I'd been practicing a few days towards a best friend. And I was experiencing a lot of joy, a lot of spaciousness, lightness, happiness, ease. And the thought of this friend came, and I remember it was almost as though there were this beautiful, it wasn't really a golden light, but it felt like a big sort of bright, beautiful, warm space. And this person just popped into that space and just dissolved into it, like just dissolved into the golden light with no impact at all on the mind. And I realized that's what it means. That's what this salt crystal implies. So by doing this, we're actually learning to, in a sense, change our karma, right? The karma that we've planted in the past doesn't always arise in the same way that it was planted. It's impossible, because if that was the case, we'd never get free. But what we can do is change our attitude now, change the quality of our mind now, change the size of the container, you know, the texture of that container, make it soft. And those things will not arise in the same way. The results will not have as much impact when the good outweighs the negative. You know, it's about bringing up the good, making the mind so full of friends that the enemies can't come in. So I'm almost over my time as usual, but I would like to say just a couple more things. And these are straight from the suttas as well, that when the mind has experienced deep states of meditation, and especially the metta meditation, there's a couple of passages there that explain how what we do next. And one of them is that the mind with metta is then able to turn towards the body and towards these five khandhas, which I mentioned, the body and mind, and see them as not self. See them as alien, see them as disintegrating, see them even as a dart and a boil. These are strong words, but they don't seem like that after metta meditation. Because again, you've gone to a place which is like a godly realm, you've gone to a place which is so much greater. And you can then see that in contrast, this body, first of all, cannot be a self, because you've transcended the realm of bodies and gone into the realm of the mind. But also that it is subject to change. It's not a reliable resting place. And the important thing here is that this is only done after metta meditation. So sometimes we try to do this too early. We get stuck. Oh, this is too much suffering for me to think about. That's not the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha's teaching is a path of happiness. So we only let go of the coarser when we have something more refined. And the other thing that the Buddha says is that after that, after we've had these experiences of deep meditation through metta, we can actually reflect that those states of samadhi are also conditioned. They're also created, if you like, in a very refined way by a very refined mind, but they're also not the final goal. And for me, this is where the Buddha's teachings differ from other religions' teachings. Other religions might talk about not-self in a similar way, or impermanence, or suffering, to some extent. But the Buddha's saying all of existence is non-self, including those divine abodes. Even those are created, conditionally arisen. And there's something even further than that, even beyond that. And that is the highest happiness of all, the happiness of Nibbana. So these states of samadhi are temporary freedoms from the defilements, freedoms from those qualities of mind. I don't like the word defilement, but the afflictive emotions, let's say, or states of mind that cause us suffering and cause suffering for others too. It's temporary freedom from that, but it's not the final goal. They allow us to see more clearly the roots, how greed and hate and delusion arise in the mind, and actually uproot them once and for all. And it's when those three roots of greed, hatred, and delusion are uprooted from the mind that we have a chance to experience Nibbana. It's one of the definitions of Nibbana: the freedom from suffering, the freedom from those unwholesome states. So I think it's beautiful to think that the end of suffering can be found through creating wholesome states. We don't have to worry so much about the unwholesome, because by developing these qualities along with wisdom, we will see how they naturally weaken and they're naturally pulled out. So I hope that we can incline our minds towards this happy path and the path of joy, and learn to tune up to an ever-increasing, subtler and more refined, more nourishing happiness than we've had perhaps before. So, let's sit and practice for some time.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.